Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. By way of introduction this evening, I was going to read the notes that Random House sent me, the accolades that 10th of December has received, and they were only truncated from many quotes, but they numbered 7 pages. So I thought I would give George more time than I gave the Random House publicity department. Sorry for that, folks. But George Saunders has received fellowships from the Lannan Foundation, the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Guggenheim Foundation. He has been awarded a MacArthur Fellowship and the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story. Entertainment Weekly has named him one of the top 100 most creative people in entertainment. The New Yorker called him one of the best writers 40 and under. And Time has recognized him as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. His 6 previous books have won many awards and legions of fans. His latest, 10th of December, was selected as one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. And just when you thought things couldn't get better, this week it became nominated as a finalist for the Story Prize, and this weekend will debut in paperback on the New York Times bestseller list at number 5 and the IndieBound list at number 3. So, we are thrilled for George. We've been admirers of his work for many years, and we are glad to know that everyone else has caught up with those of us in this room who have been in the know. Would you please join me in welcoming George Saunders?
Thank you, Charles. Thank you so much. I think that was such a nice introduction that I think we should just stop right there, and I won't screw it up, and we can just call it a night. It's great to be here at one of the greatest bookstores in America, the Tattered Cover. I'm so happy and proud to be here. It's such a great representative of this indie spirit that our country needs in our book selling. So thank you for having me. Also, I don't know if it's kind of like kosher to dedicate a reading, but I can call it, right? So I want to say, many years ago, I met a man named Ted Shook, who's here. Where are you, Ted? Right, there he is. And Ted gave me my first job in geophysics and sent me to Asia, which was an incredibly mind-blowing experience. And when I was there, I got to hang out a little bit with Ted and Marcia. And not only was Ted a great role model, but as a couple, they were so positive and loving with each other that it got in my mind. And I carried that around until I met my wife. So thank you so much for that. Really great to see you again after all these years. Yeah. Okay, so I thought I'd read a little, because I don't think anyone's ever left a reading going, God, I wish he'd read longer. right? I don't know. I had a cab ride or a taxi, or what do you call it, a driver one time, this Polish guy, and he said to me, so are you going now to do reading? I said, yeah. He said, little advice for you, don't read too much. I was like, oh, you know my work. He said, no, the people, they don't like reading. So I'll read a little bit here. I think this part is pretty self-explanatory, but it's from a story called The Semco Girl Diaries. It took me 14 years to write for, I don't know why. And it's a diary entry, so it's a little truncated, missing articles. And whenever you hear plus or equal, it's actually a mathematical symbol because the narrator's tired. It's late in the day, and he's just jotting down a few notes. When you come into a situation like this, I'm kind of a dark writer, and I want to read something kind of upbeat and not mordant. So I picked this, but of course it's set at a funeral, so, it's not. Okay. September 30th. Sorry for silence. Crazy thing happened this week. Monday, Todd Grassberger died. Future readers know Todd. Have I mentioned? probably have not mentioned. Todd, not close friend, just work colleague. Todd and I had running joke, RE, I had never returned Firewire I had borrowed. In fact, was company Firewire, not his. He knew. I knew he knew. It was just our joke. Day started out fine. Beautiful Indian summer day. Fire drill in morning. Whole complex emptied into outdoor courtyard. Day so beautiful, no one minded. Everyone lounging on berms, urging caution. Fun to see people of different companies, like seeing members of different tribes. Nabromax equal nerds. Calculating temperature needed to destroy, by fire, entire complex. Urged equal design firm. Has many hippies, prettiest girls. Many urged folks lying on backs on berms, looking up at clouds. One guy playing small wood flute. When all clear sounded, everyone booed, all filed sadly back inside. Then at 2, word rippled through office. Todd, dead. Had heart attack at dry cleaner. Just now, during lunch. All afternoon, no one working. Everyone stunned, milling around, trying to process fact that Todd equal dead. Under Todd's desk, pair of hiking boots. Against one wall, walking stick Todd used to take on lunchtime walks in woods. Weird sun shower around 3. Linda Hurtney. It's like a final goodbye from Todd. Linda equal nut. Once claimed crow on ledge was reincarnation of her dead husband. Said she could tell by way crow's head was cocked disapprovingly at large lunch she was eating. Then storm over, parking lot glistening. All evening found myself looking afresh at Pam, kids. Everything suddenly precious. Said prayer before dinner. Do not usually pray before dinner, but tonight, held hands, prayed. Prayed we'd be grateful for our good fortune, grateful for each other. Prayed we'd remember that various ups, downs we may experience as family equal small bumps in road compared with this. Prayed for Todd, prayed for Todd's family. Just nights ago, Todd was in own house doing whatever Todd did at night. Taking change out of pockets, having laugh with kids, petting dog, thinking of future, tossing dirty clothes in hamper. Where is Todd tonight? October 1st. Todd Grassberger funeral today at Ukrainian Church downtown. Todd, apparently from humble roots. Priest equal long-haired guy in cassock. Sings, chants whole service in Ukrainian from memory. As he chants paces, cassock rope swings. Scary guy. Very intense. Sermon. Why this surprising? Did you think you were going to live forever? Only difference between you, sitting there anticipating the rest of your day, and Todd, in coffin, bound for eternal home in cold earth, is heartbeat. Feel that, people? In your chests? That is thin line between you and grave. So why do you live like you're eternal? That foolish. You are fools. This scary? This not scary. This truth. This reality. Shouts, shall we wake up? Shall we? Everyone staring big-eyed at priest. Except usual congregants who seem to have heard all before. Priest goes on. Which of us will die tonight? Do we think he's being facetious? That shows we are dopes. Any one of us could die tonight. Die right now. Suddenly come up short of breath, keel over in pew, be with Todd in earth in wink of eye. Suddenly from downstairs kitchen, smell of roast beef. Happy chatter from church ladies down in kitchen. Smell of roast beef plus sound of pots clanking, plates being set out equal appealing. People shifting in pews due to amazing smell of beef. Todd's two brothers come to lectern and make tributes. Older brother, Todd, sweet. Todd, funny. Todd, a powerful force in his life. We'll never forget wonder that was Todd. Younger brother, yes, Todd, super strong person. Todd equal bull. Although Todd could be somewhat firm, Todd did younger brother much good. in long run by teaching him how to stand up for self. That is to say, having been pushed around by Todd throughout entire childhood, nothing can now faze younger brother, i.e. no bully in outside world will ever be equal of Todd. But Todd's so great. Todd the best. Todd so smart, so good looking. No wonder Todd's mom plus dad always treated him, younger brother, like afterthought. But Todd's so caring, so perceptive. Todd understood this, would sometimes console younger brother by saying that he, younger brother, was perfectly fine in own way. Often just before breaking pact they had made, RE Wednesday night being younger brother's night to borrow dad's car, thereby ruining younger brother's chance to see girl he really liked, possible love of life. Girl he eventually lost to dope from Selden. Dope whose own older brother, apparently more inclined than Todd, to give his younger brother a decent shot at family car. Todd's younger brother, breathless, pauses at lectern, can't seem to stop self, plunges ahead. But Todd great. Todd so great. Todd will surely be missed. Todd taught everyone in family an important lesson. Although a person might be strong, bellicose, ambitious, slightly blind to needs of others, still, that does not mean person not greatest, most amazing brother ever, who occasionally, as if to spite self, might suddenly, surprising all, do some reasonably thoughtful thing. Younger brother, seemingly perplexed by own tribute, then led away from lectern by scowling older brother, hissing something in undertone. Todd's widow approaches lectern. Can't seem to speak. Three little girls clinging to her skirt. Widow hands microphone to smallest girl. Smallest girl, bye, daddy. Lunch, good. Lunch beyond good. Funeral so sad, lunch equal heaven. Eat three roast beef sandwiches in row off paper plate. Outside, yellow tree blowing in wind. Single yellow leaf blows in through open basement window. Watch it come down, land near my shoe. Think, life beautiful. So glad I'm not dead. If, when I die, do not want Pam lonely. Want her to remarry, have full life. As long as new husband is nice guy. Gentle guy. Religious guy. Very caring, plus good to kids. But kids not fooled. Kids prefer dead dad, i.e. me, to religious guy. Pale, boring religious guy with no oomph, who wears weird sweaters and is always a little sad due to cannot get boner, due to physical ailment. Death very much on my mind, future reader. Can it be true that I will die, that Pam, kids will die? Is awful. Why were we put here? So inclined to love when end of our story equal death. That harsh. That cruel. Do not like. Note to self, try harder in all things to be better person. And I'll stop right there. So now I think we are in the question and answer portion of the program. So I've been touring this book for a while, and there's this really interesting phenomenon that the first person in the room to ask a question always ends up to have the most sexual energy in the room. It's kind of this, it's some kind of Darwinian thing. I don't know what it's. Oh, that was a bluff. Think about the implications of that, sir. Oh, thank you, thank you. Thanks, thanks. Anybody? Anybody? Yes, sir.
Just wondering if you might reflect on voice and your own voice and where it comes from.
Sure. The question is, could I reflect on voice and where my voice comes from? For me, the whole process of, you know, finding one's voice was many, many years of suppressing it because I was a little ashamed of it. You know, I've got this fast Chicago you know, kind of Alvin and the Chipmunks thing going on. And so when I was younger, I didn't like that, and I didn't, and I really aspired to be a kind of classic Hemingway-esque writer, you know, very no humor, kind of lyrical nature description and so on. So I kind of labored at that for a long time, and, you know, I guess not surprisingly, couldn't get any real traction. So it took kind of a crisis. My wife and I were, we met, we got engaged in 3 weeks, had two kids within 2.5 years, and in both pregnancies, she had to go to bed for 4 months because of, she went into early labor. So by the time we'd known each other 3 years, we were kind of like, you know, we'd been married for 40 years, and we were kind of harried. And so anyway, in this period, I kept saying, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to get it. Just, you know, you're sitting on a gold mine. Just wait. And so went down to Mexico and tried to write this novel out of this really wonderful kind of week-long experience, and it was a bomb. It was took 2 years, and it was 700 words, and I was staying up late at night drinking, like, coffee in Boone's Farm to try to, you know. And at the end, I gave it to her, and it was just, you know, she read it and just sat there with her head in her hands, like, I can't get past page six. It was so, you know. So that was bad. And, you know, just to give you some idea of how great the book was, the name of it was La Boda de Eduardo, which I think means like Ed's wedding, you know. Like, but it was Joyce meets Hemingway meets Quaaludes, which I don't know, what a kind of big bummer. So anyway, but so it's funny now, but it was 700 pages. I cut it to 350, and it just didn't even make sense. So in rebound from that, I wrote some funny poems that were just really scatological Dr. Seuss kind of things. And when she read that, she actually reacted. She laughed, you know. And something a switch threw in my mind, and I thought, oh, God, you're such an idiot. You know, all this time you've been trying to make energy on the page but keeping all your natural instincts to the side. So it was literally like a scrim fell, and I thought, humor, whether you like it or not, you know, whether you feel low when you do it, it's all you got. Same with pop culture and, you know, sort of sci-fi stuff. And literally in one day, I just sort of went, oh, I got it, you know. And so that's when my you know, so-called voice first kind of appeared. And it was sort of disappointing, actually. You know, I kind of had something grander in mind. It was like all those years I'd had this this medical affliction called the Hemingway boner, and I just loved Hemingway so much. You know, so it was like this mountain, Hemingway Mountain. I love you. I'm going up you. And so I used to copy his stories out by hand, and everything I tried to see in Hemingway-esque terms. And then you get up to the top of it, and you know, if you're lucky as a young writer, you get close and you realize that you're never going to be equal to him. He's going to want you to be down here. And also, you've been filling up this basket with these hurtful personal experiences, you know, this kind of painful accretion of stuff that you actually know about the world that can't actually be expressed in that other voice. You know, Nick walked into the Walmart. You know, it doesn't work. So then you kind of go, oh, all right, that's ridiculous. And you come down, and you're so cleansed, and then you say, yeah, I'm working class. And you look over, and there's Kerouac Mountain. He's a working class guy. That's what, and you go up there. So I did that for many years, and that when I wrote those first funny stories, it was almost like going, okay, oh, look, there's a little dunghill, and it's got my name, and it's misspelled and handwritten. Yeah, you know. But at the same time, it was very sweet because it did feel like, you know, for better or worse, that's kind of what I can do. So that was kind of it in a nutshell, you know. So I teach at Syracuse, and we get like 600 applications this year for 6 places, and that's the whole game: is how do you get somebody to do that thing that, one, that only they can do, and two, that might not be all that pleasant. It's not like you say, oh, I'm going to assume the Faulknerian wreath, and Faulkner says, yes, please do. It's much more, you know, uncomfortable. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I was fascinated with the Suffolk Diaries. Is that my thing?
Yes, you are. Yeah, thank you.
And I'm just interested in your science fiction influences. Hmm. And I'm not a sci-fi person at all.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so, frankly, my wife, who is very into sci-fi, helped me along the way.
Right. She's a good helper. I know her. Yeah.
So I'm just curious as to how that came about.
Sure.
What was talking in the back of your head while you were writing that influence-wise?
Right. So to repeat, the question was about this story called The Semple Girl Diaries, which is kind of a sci-fi romp, and how that happened.
I was reading it very literally.
Yeah, well, I think I mean you to read it literally. Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you the honest truth, because in this setting, the tendency is to want to dress it up with, you know, well, that's about patriarchy, of course, you know. But that one really just was a dream. I had a dream one night in Syracuse when our kids were little, and in the dream I went to this window in our house, looked into the yard, and there was a beautiful moonlit night. And on a kind of a, almost like a clothesline, there were these five women that I understood to be from kind of third world impoverished backgrounds, just in that dream logic. And they had on these long white gowns, and the wire went right through their heads like this. They were like paper dolls, kind of, you know. So that was a little odd. But then the part that made me want to write it was in that dream logic, that guy that I was didn't go, oh, my God, call 911. He was so grateful. Like a deep gratitude, and the feeling was, oh, finally I got those, and our kids can go to school and hold their heads up. All the other kids have them, you know. And it was funny because it was at that time we had just gotten them into a nice school, we had gotten a slightly bigger house, and we were doing good. So that kind of deep fatherly, husbandly gratitude that I was feeling in real life just got picked up and put into that guy's chest in the dream, you know. So I think, you know, a lot of times you wake up from a dream going, that would make a great story. But, you know, if it's usually like a penguin orgy or something, and that doesn't. But in this case, it was baffling and it was troubling, you know. And so this was in 1998, and I just started goofing around with that and kind of blundered into the diary form. So my whole thing about writing is you're not really supposed to know what it means. Maybe never. You know, maybe very, very late in the game. But what you're trying to do is get the thing to be energetic. And the way you do that is by baffling yourself in some way. You know, right? There's a... Gerald Stern had this great quote that I'm overusing, but it's like my mantra. He said, if you set out to write a poem about two dogs fucking, and you write a poem about two dogs fucking, then you wrote a poem about two dogs fucking. You know? And then the other quote I associate with that is Mr. Schmarty Pants Einstein, who didn't even swear when he said it. He said, no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. Right, so the idea would be you get into a story like that, you don't know what it means. There's all kinds of voices in your head saying, oh, I know the theme, you know, and you say, get thee behind me. I don't want to talk right now. I just want to make the thing sort of get up on its feet and walk. And the end goal is to put you through an invigorating, maybe even confusing experience. So I think you should see it as a real people in the real world and so on. So the answer is I really don't know. I guess, how about that? Yeah. Sir?
I don't really know much about you. I just kind of found out about you recently. And when I was reading through your book, I picked up various strange influences. It reminded me a lot about actually Steinbeck, John Steinbeck.
Yeah, thank you. I love Steinbeck.
And I was wondering, you know, I already heard that, you know, from your first question that you admired Hemingway. Did you draw influences from any other parts of literature you admired?
Sure. I mean, Steinbeck, you got a good ear, because Steinbeck, the question about influences in Steinbeck in particular, and he was a big influence. When I was going to the School of Mines, I worked a summer job in Amarillo, Texas, in the oil fields. And I my parents had got this old RV, and so I was kind of living in that for the summer and working with a bunch of people who were, like, one guy had just gotten out of jail, one was a Vietnam vet, and it was kind of a rough crew. And I was reading Grapes of Wrath along, and for the first time, I kind of got it about, you know, poverty and all that kind of stuff. So I think Steinbeck is one. And the other person I really love is this Russian writer, Isaac Babel, who he's kind of a contemporary of Hemingway's, and he was real lean like that, but a little more lyrical, kind of a little more hallucinogenic. So I think those are probably two big ones. And then also, Tobias Wolff was my teacher at Syracuse, and he was just as a person and as a writer, such a huge influence. He was so, you know, he's a tough guy, a big guy, great artist, but also a great teacher and very gentle person. So I think when I went to Syracuse, I thought you had to be kind of dysfunctional and maybe addicted to something if you're going to be a writer. And I didn't really want to be, and I kind of wasn't. But so seeing him, you know, who had a real functional, wonderful life and was just a madman in the writing room was really kind of a big permission giver, you know. Yes, sir. Sure, yeah.
The one thing that I really loved about that story was it felt like he was writing some of the influences of Tobias Wolff and Hemingway, the kind of simple or very church kind of prose, things like that. But then also has this really interesting kind of magical element or this, you know, this different otherworldly. And I really love this space of realism, but then also with this added layer of something very strange or bizarre.
Right.
And I was just have to ask if you have any kind of things that you like to do or tips tips or advice to how to stay in that space.
Right.
It's really difficult to pull off.
It is difficult.
But what I admire about the story was that it was so seamless.
Well, thanks.
When you talk about these things that were going on, they're so bizarre. It's just as if it was like any ordinary thing that was going on.
Right. So the question is about the story Sea Oak that was in my second book, and it's got kind of a weird, it's kind of a mashup of realism and magic realism. And I'll tell you the truth. I really try to not think in those categories at all when I'm working, because if you say, I'll give you a simple example. If someone says, well, I don't know if I should be a funny writer or a serious writer. Well, I mean, the answer is yes. You should. You know, you should do whatever you can do. But if you make that opposition, then I think what happens is at a critical moment in the story, when you're lost, as you should be, you go, oh, yeah, I'm the funny guy. You know, or I'm the seer, or I'm the experimental, or I'm the realist. And then suddenly you kind of like lower the ceiling on yourself a little bit. So I think the idea is to kind of go, you know, by any means necessary, I'm trying to get the reader to lean in and really have an intimate moment with me. And that way you sort of say, well, since I'm a child of this culture, I know everything. I know sci-fi. I know The Simpsons. I know Honey Boo Boo. I know, you know, Faulkner. I know Dante. I mean, it's all fair game. So then you say, let me make my first priority to try to engage and then move you emotionally by any means. So then what happened is you write yourself, you know, with Einstein's thing in mind, you'll have an idea of what the story's about. You'll have an idea of how it's going to proceed. And what I find is the story will go, oh, no, you don't. Stick it. You know, you don't, you condescend to me in that way, and it'll lock you up, you know. So in that story, I had some funny shtick about this, you know, kind of white trashy family. The aunt dies, and then I got stuck for about 4 years, and I wrote something like 350 pages of alternate endings, six or seven fully polished endings. And then I'd go back and read them, and right at that scene, I would go, no, that's these are after-school specials somehow. You know, and I knew that, you know, she was dead. The most interesting character was dead. And I kept thinking, well, okay, maybe the story's about how they catch her killer, you know, and she comes back in a dream to tell them. Or maybe it's about them getting out of the housing complex. And it always felt like, bleh. You know, once you got there, it was like, yeah, the first part was better. So I went on a vacation, and I was mowing the grass or something like that, and I was thinking, why are you such an idiot? You know, these are writerly thoughts. Why are you such an idiot? What's wrong? Why can't you finish this stupid story? You know she has to come back. And I say to myself, yeah, but I tried the dream sequence. And Toby Wolf told me once, he said, be careful. In your writing career, you are allowed two dream sequences. That's it. So and I tried, you know, a flashback, and it didn't work. So I'm kind of muttering to myself, I know she's got to come back. She's got to come back. And then, you know how your mind is just, who knows what it is. It blurted out, I know she has to come back from the dead. And suddenly, all my years of watching The Twilight Zone, like, oh, I know how to do that. So part of the reason I think that story works is I really had no intention of doing that. I fought it and fought it and fought it. And finally, this story said, I won't be finished in that mode. Think of something better. Be honest, you know. And somehow that was the move that came out. So I think the trick is to not categorize and kind of just say, my only thing I want to do is get into a really non-condescending relationship with my very intelligent, well-traveled reader. And my basic working technique is just to take the story I printed out the day before and kind of inch up to it and say, okay, I don't know what this is. I have no real attachment to it from yesterday. Let me just read it. And then kind of imagine there's a meter in my head. And this one says positive and this says negative, and just start reading and see what it does. And if you're not too hung up on what you thought yesterday, you can see, you know, your reading energy goes up and then you get to page 2.5 and go, ooh. And that's kind of where you start revising, you know. So that's kind of it. And then if you're doing that, you'll find ways to keep the surface lively, you know, that something like that. I don't know. Yes, sir, in the back.
Hi.
Hi.
What was the
Best advice I received starting out? Well, it was kind of, I had a wonderful teacher named Douglas Unger, who now teaches at UNLV, and it was just in the middle of a conference, and he gave me this offhanded advice about dialogue that I've never been quite able to articulate, but he said something like, bad dialogue is when A asks a question and B answers it, because people don't do that. You know, when we're talking, I've got a thought bubble over my head. Oh, this guy's really taking his time. I got to get out of here. You know, I got to go see Sydney. Sydney, that big asshole. I hate Sydney. And meanwhile, you have one too, which is George doesn't need to be concentrating. What a jerk. I've always thought that about him. And then when you say something and I respond, I'm responding out of that kind of weird thought stream, you know. So my answer is going to go a little bit off. and then you're just like a tennis ball, and you're going to reach over and hit it back, but it's going to come out of your thought stream. So he said, if you see your dialogue answering neatly, especially if it somehow is fulfilling some plot function, then it's going to be dead on the page. So just that idea of people firing missiles past each other was really helpful. And he said something about how well-written dialogue is like poetry. It's not functional, but it actually looks good on the page, and it has a kind of a zinginess. And somehow, in the way that real good writing advice does, he caught me right at the moment when I could hear that, and it, my dialogue writing changed after that forever. So that was one really practical thing that I heard.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I just recently read Civil War Land, from Dan Klein, and I found myself laughing quite a bit, but also being terribly disturbed.
Yeah.
I kept on thinking, the guy that wrote this, is he really?
I thank you for not completing that sentence.
You're a very happy person.
I'm happy. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So within yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand you're trying to engage people that are readers and
right.
bring them along for the ride, but that was some ride.
Well, thanks. Yeah.
I'm wondering why, what it was that you were seeing when you
Right. No, that's a great question. The question is about Civil War and Bad Decline. It was fun, but also disturbing, and he's surprised to see that I'm so suave. And, I was at an event the other day, and a guy asked a similar question, and he said perky, which was really not what else. No, I hear what you're saying. I mean, the first thing is to do something energetic. I think at that time, the truth is, I was, my wife and I had our two daughters then, no money. I was 32 or something, and it was starting to occur to me that I wasn't a child prodigy, that ship had kind of sailed. And then also there was something, I was working for a tech writing company at the time, an environmental company, and it wasn't bad, but I was not doing well, and I was kind of floundering. So somehow, for the first time, it occurred to me that things could go really badly in America. I don't know why it took that, but just that... you could have a dream and you could have a hope and the world might not respond. And then you were left to deal with it. And then in a certain way, that was writ large, that was the part of the American story. And it was one that felt really urgent to me at that time because it was such a revelation because I was such an idiot, So that idea, that Terry Eagleton idea that capitalism plunders the sensuality of the body was kind of real to me. So I think that was maybe behind a little bit. And also, there's a great Chekhov story called Gooseberries. And in there, he's got this line that says, every happy man should have an unhappy man in his closet with a hammer. to remind him by his constant tapping that not everyone is happy, and sooner or later life will show him its claws, So I don't know if I had that in mind, but I think that was the gut thing was, let me show you the worst day. Let me show you what we're like when our resources are depleted and we have bad luck. And then as sort of like a thought experiment, let's see what resources we have to respond. Now that to me even now feels a little bit overthought, because at the time I really was just trying not to do what I had been doing, kind of tepid, literary, quasi-purple, that kind of thing where the reason you know it's literary is because you don't like it, and you're describing, and also you describe everything three times, the cat sat on the black table, the plainer ebony horizon, the dark tinted flatness. You're like, what? So I was really reacting against that. But the answer is I don't really, I don't. I know that I'm kind of a weird person, actually. I mean, I've known that since I was a little kid. There's something odd going on. So the trick is to kind of, tame it and normalize it and not let it just be fluky, but try to say, well, is there any way that can intersect with actual conditions to make something that might be meaningful to someone who's less weird, but also less perky, That's I don't know what that. Yeah. Yes.
Can you talk a bit about multiple points of view in this last book? There's so many stories that just rotate back and forth through
right.
multiple people.
Sure. The question is about the maybe four stories in here that have multiple points of view. I think of that as this thing called third person ventriloquist. So the idea is it's kind of a standard third person omniscient, but then quickly you go into somebody's head, and once you're in there, you sign the terms and conditions, which are I have to use his diction, I have to be limited by his or her neuroses and fears and all that. So in a way, it's just a trick to get at some different voices. The first book was all like in first person present, and I was kind of tired of it. So on one level, it's just a constraint and kind of a trick to generate you know, funny voices. But then I think also there, I think I like it because there's a deeper truth in it, which is that if we looked at what's actually going on in this room, I mean, in omniscient third person, it's a gathering of wonderful people sat in a wonderful bookstore in Denver, a city in the Western United States. And that's true as far as it goes. But in reality, it's actually, you know, whatever it is, 200 thought streams going 90 miles an hour in both verbal mode and not verbal mode, twinges, itchy butts, the whole thing is going on. And that's actually probably as close as we could get to a semi-objective reality, which is, you know, 180, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. So for me, when I start a story and say, well, let's just pick out two of those, or usually it's just one, and then something will happen that indicates I need a second one. But I like that because it sort of feels honest to me. You know, it's not a lot of invention. It's just a guy thinking. And often what will happen is the guy thinking, it becomes a verbal riff. You're playing a verbal game. It's like when you're a kid and you try to imitate somebody. And then as he's doing that, he'll say something that will create plot in some way. So, and I'm not a subtle guy, but for example, in this first story in this book is called Victory Lap, and there's a 15-year-old girl who's thinking at her house very happily. And while I was typing that, just trying to make her voice kind of funny, she said something like, to do good, all you have to do is be good. If you want to be brave, just be brave. Which is something I kind of believe as a teenager. Like, what are all you divorced alcoholics doing? You know, why not just cut it out? You know, be a success. And so when she wrote that, it was kind of a funny, sweet line. And I thought, you know, and then as the author, you say, all you have to do to be good is be good. And you kind of say, really? You know, and then you get a little diabolical and you say, I love you, but I'm going to have to test that for you. So then you think, well, how can I test it? And then then plot appears, you know. So if you have a sort of valid, exaggerated, entertaining human mind stream, he will make plot for you, you know. Someone said, the one thing I really hate is raccoons. Aha! Cue the raccoons, you know. So I think that, for me, it's sort of a mechanical thing in that way, you know. And I really enjoy writing that mode. Anybody else? Yes.
When you write a story, when or how do you know when it's done?
You must be a writer, I expect. Yeah. The question was, when you write a story, how do you know it's done? And that is really, I mean, it's the million-dollar question, but it's also the one that I think each person has to kind of feel their way toward, because I've talked to all kinds of writers, and everyone will tell you something different. I mean, I think the thing about writing that's interesting is there isn't really an objective truth. It's just kind of faking it till you make it. I mean, you're trying to put together a set of practices and ways of thinking that produce prose for you. So whatever works for you works. But for me, it's kind of like a feeling of, I tend to write a little bit and then go back and refine. And at some point it feels, the word I always think is undeniable. It feels like what was there actually happened. There's not any wiggle room. There's not any loose text. It happened. And then I can move on to the next section. So the stories tend to kind of go, you know, page one, page one, page one and a half, whoops, page half, page one, 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 two, two, three, whoops, two, like that. And it's almost like if you were painting, I don't know why you would do this, but if you're painting the floor of a house, I guess you wouldn't, but, and you know, you want it to be nice and smooth and beautiful, and you worked and worked, and then you noticed a patch that was rough, you go back, and then at one point the whole room looks perfect, and you're at the door, and there's one little bare spot, you know. So the last movement of the story is usually the very last paragraph. You know, the story has kind of told you itself, and you know where you are, and you kind of step out of the room with one little swipe of the paintbrush. But for me, it's the diagnostic thing is the language. If it's tight, if as I'm reading it, that needle stays in the positive, and I don't feel any falseness or any repetition or something, then I kind of just go on. But, you know, that's, yeah. Yes?
Kind of tying into that, you said that story took you 14 years.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up again.
What is that process like?
Yeah, you know, I tend to have. Yeah, the question is about that 14-year story. Why, you know, what was going on during the 14? It's I usually try to have four or five or six things going on at once. And when I go in the morning, I just kind of really feel like what would be fun, what would be interesting. Gravitate to that one. So that one, I'd kind of, you know, get into it, work on it for 2 or 3 weeks, and then hit the same wall. There was a seam in that story, like in that other one, where I just couldn't get past it. So kind of pound on the door a lot, and then at some point go, oh, I'm sick of this, and put it away. So I would probably, I probably worked on that 2 months a year for 14 years. And then sometimes I would feel like the trail was hot and I'd do 4 or 5 months, and, you know, but always with all the things. I really haven't had an empty desk since 1986. So, 'cause I don't like that moment when you're, what shall I write? You know. Yes, ma'am.
Do you ever review your work and read aloud or record yourself and listen to it later?
I don't. I mean, I've done the audiobook for this one, but I don't do that. I mean, one, because I don't like my voice very much, but also I think there's a way you can kind of do that internally. You know, you're sort of reading it, scanning it. I can make cuts better in that mode than reading aloud. That when I do those voices, there's kind of a it's weird, but it's at the back of my throat. I can feel hear/feel that voice, and then reproduce it. And then as you put it down, you're kind of like, that's not quite right, and you edit. But I don't do much of the reading aloud so much. No.
What about reading to yourself aloud?
Not really. My own stuff, you mean, or not really? I guess it's just kind of more. This question is about reading work aloud. I'm sorry. Yeah. I really don't. I kind of just hear it. It's not quite silent, but it's kind of mental reading. Yeah. I read, but I'm mental. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
You had mentioned that you know, give your wife kind of some of the things that you've written to read. Is there any other place or anyone else that reads your stuff before it goes to an editor or a publisher?
There really isn't. I did the MFA program and I kind of burned out on that whole thing. I mean, it's a good thing to go through, but not for long. So after there, I thought the question was about whether anyone else reads my work before my wife. I just feel like I have to really be solid with it myself, you know, because if you send something out that you're not sure of and the world rejects it, you don't quite know what just happened. But likewise, if you send it out and you're not sure and the world accepts it, you're on really shaky ground. So I kind of go to pretty obsessive lengths to make sure I really like it. Then I give it to my wife, and she, you know, we've been married 27 years, and she knows all my shit. And so she'll say, it's just like, you copped out on page 5, you know, or it was good up till page 8, and then you're just, you know what you're doing. I'm like, and of course then you say, oh, I don't know why I even gave it to her, you know, and then you storm around for a few days. But she's a really wonderful reader, and she reads on a very emotional basis. Either it moves her or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then she's like, yeah, you know, it's clever. But if it moves her, then I win. And then from there I send it to The New Yorker, and that's really about it. Yeah. Yes?
Have you ever written a story that was like painless, you know, it took you like a short amount of time, it flowed out really well, and it's easy, and if it did happen, did that worry you? Do you feel like you have to labor over a story, or can it be as simple as that?
Sure. The question was, did I ever have a story that came out easily and fun, and I didn't have to worry? I have had close to that. In this book, there's a story called Home that I wrote basically in one night. I'm superstitious, so I went back and edited it for 3 months afterwards. And it got better. You know, it really got better. So the impulse was there, the shape was there, but the details got better in that. But I think one of the things that's weird about this writing thing is that, you know, in any job, we want to have mastery. And I think not only in our jobs, but probably in our whole life, we want to coast. Isn't that what we really want? I finally found the spiritual truth that I can coast. I find the person who I love, who I never have to even worry about again. You know, I'm only eating cheese the rest of my life. Like, you want to kind of, and in art, I think you want to find the method. That's kind of what. But I think the trick is the method is always changing. You know, it's like you're on a cruise ship. Your job is to juggle. The ship is sinking. It's coated with ice. You're wearing roller skates and you're drunk. It's, you know, you don't really get to stabilize, you know. So I think the thing is you have to be willing to accept that some stories take 14 years, and maybe some magical day you could write one that takes an hour. You know, I think you have to be willing to say, I will take it however I get it. And I won't be so egocentric as to think either I have to work 20 years or it would be sullying it to overwork it. You just have to sort of say, well, how's it going? And I'll do whatever is necessary. Yes. Ah. Well, the question is that she said there's despair in the stories and there's kind of joy, and what's the proper relation or posture. I think it's just that, you know. Is life good or bad? Yep. You know, and we all know that. I mean, is fresh cut grass great? Yes, it is. How about falling off a bridge? That sucks. You know, or how about having your heart broken? That is terrible. You know, or that's a little trivial. I mean, the horrible things that can happen that are happening right now, totally true. Also, the most wonderful day in your life, equally true. So I think part of the, it's an aesthetic challenge, but I think for me, it's also kind of a personhood challenge, is to say that's all right. You know, I don't have to deny one or the other. And I think certain forms of immature art will say either everything's rosy, we're so happy, you know, because we try hard. And then the other one says everything sucks. Capitalism, man. The corporations. And both of those feel a little juvenile because we know better, you know. We know better at a visceral level. So I think part of the fun of a story can be that you can sort of faint one direction. Life is miserable. And then you can put in the other valence, and suddenly those two things are resonating. And the reader looks to you like, well, which do I believe? And you go, oh, excuse me, I have to go on to the next paragraph, you know. I mean, for me, Chekhov is the one who really does it so beautifully. You never know where he stands, you know, but you know he's really awake to everything. So that's kind of, you know, the goal. And I think it's harder. It's much easier to sort of be Mr. Disaster, you know. But to kind of credit both is really fun. Yes.
This is kind of a job question, I'm sorry, but what do you think your biggest weakness is?
Biggest weakness, oh man. My biggest weakness as a writer. I think it's that I'm insecure and I want to show off with every sentence. I don't want you to drift away, you know. And I feel like if I let up for even one sentence, you're gonna go away. I think most weaknesses in writing are both strengths and weaknesses. That's I think when you break through, you realize that they're the same, you know. So that's one of the reasons my stories are kind of manic, is because I don't want to lose you, you know. And then I think as you sort of hopefully go up the ladder, you learn to work with that in a sophisticated way. So you say, all right, what am I sacrificing with that quality? And what I'm sacrificing is certain quiet moments where you have time to catch your breath, or maybe the things I have to say aren't particularly witty, or they're a little banal even. So in this book, I felt there were a couple paragraphs in particular where I had a witty or kind of ironic thing, and I just said, what happens if I sacrifice the verbal pizzazz? And in all those cases, I thought anyway that it kind of made the story more emotionally resonant. So that's really what I struggle with, you know, just as a person too. You know, I don't want to be bland, which then sometimes it means you're obnoxious or perky. You know, you could be... Do we have time for maybe just one more question? Yes, sir.
Is there something that you feel like people never ask about that you wish that they asked about?
The question is, is there something that people never ask about that I wish they would ask about? No. I mean, there really is. Everything I want to ask, it always gets asked. No, I mean, the one thing that I'll tweak your question a bit. The one thing I always like to talk about is this, especially if there's writers in the crowd, which there usually are, is the idea that the superpower in writing is two. One is sort of being a little gentle with yourself, and while the other is being really harsh with yourself. But the third thing is revision. Like, I labored for many years under the misconception that your first draft was the litmus test. If your first draft was no good, shit, I had to go to law school, you know. And the thing that kind of helped me was to go, actually, you're not your first draft at all. You're not even your 50th draft. You're not your story. That's just the byproduct of you, and you have infinite right to go in there and tweak it forever if you like. And as you do that, what happens is, I've found sometimes when you're lucky, the person you are in day-to-day life is inadequate. You know, I don't really feel that, you know, great about me. But if you give me 6 years and let me come back to a story again and again, it'll be smarter than me by far. It'll be funnier for sure. It'll be faster and it'll be nicer, kinder, you know. So that, to me, is like a real comforting thing. And all those years when I was kind of struggling, you could just sort of say, you know, don't worry about it. Just keep coming back to it again and again. And that seems to me like the real key to a sort of healthy and long writing life. All right. Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado.
Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.